linguistic art chicks.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. And can you believe it? I'm back for a second time in 1 week. Well, what I can't believe is that in the short time since my last podcast, we already received donations from Mark A. and Lee M. And Mark and Lee, thank you. It doesn't seem like I'm ever saying enough to thank all of our donors throughout the year, but I guess it'll have to do for now. So maybe the best way to say thank you to all of our donors is to get on with the show. And so today we're going to hear once again from Dr. Timothy Leary. Now, when I first previewed this tape, I thought that maybe I've podcasted already, but I don't think so. My problem is that I've heard so many of his and Terrence McKenna's talks that I just can't keep them straight in my mind anymore. And on top of that, they often repeat their stories and they give a number of variations on a particular theme, which also makes it kind of difficult to remember if you've heard a particular talk or not. Anyway, this talk also comes from the Timothy Leary Archive, thanks to Dennis Berry and Bruce Damer, and it's the first of two tapes that were in a directory simply labeled Horowitz, and the files were labeled Leary Live SF 1979, and it's part one, tracks one and two. So all I know for sure is that it's from a talk, or performance, I should say, in a hall in San Francisco in early 1979, which is about 3 years after he was released from prison. But as I just said, it may have been a recording of the same night that came from another source and that I sampled here before. Heck, I just really don't know. So here's the deal. I'm putting this podcast out just a few days after my previous one with Alan Watts, because next week I won't be able to get a program out until the end of the week, so this will be a little buffer. And if you want to hear the second hour of this talk, you can let me know via the comments section in the program notes for this podcast, which you know you can find at psychedelicsalon.org. But next week, no matter what the consensus about hearing more of today's talk, I'm going to play one of the new McKenna talks that I've been receiving from our fellow saloners. I don't know what it'll be about yet, because I haven't heard any of these myself. So I'm just as anxious as you are. Now, getting back to today's program, the reason I remember hearing this recording once before is because of the introduction. It was Grace Slick who introduced him that night, and I think you'll recognize her voice right away. And it sounds to me as if old Grace had perhaps mistimed her medicine slightly, but hey, that happens to the best of us. In any event, it's a classic introduction for sure. So let's join her now, but let me warn you ahead of time, the crowd gets a little rowdy before the end of this part of his talk, and I left it all uncut to give you a little better idea of the way Dr. Leary's public appearances were like back in 1979, a little over 30 years ago. And where were you on that winter evening when Grace Slick walked up to the microphone and said...
I was going to make some semi-humorous comments about endless beginnings and metamorphosis and the cyclic intellect of the 60s in San Francisco, but this feels more like a sort of a kitchen laboratory where people are hungry, waiting for the real food. The appetizers were good, you know, but I can feel that give me the food stuff. And I'm just as anxious to hear him as you are. So here he comes, the Commodore, Timothy Leary.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I'm happy to be in San Francisco, the neurological Dodge City by the Bay. It's a great privilege and honor to have Grace here tonight, and Paul and the members of the Starship. Thank you for being here. Could we have the lights so there's more lights on everybody, so that I'm going to demonstrate with scientific evidence, anthropological data, ethological reports, to anyone's satisfaction that for the last 4,000 or 5,000 years, freedom and intelligence and individualism has been moving in an unbroken chain from east to west. So that here on the banks of the Pacific Ocean, we obviously have assembled the most advanced nervous systems on the planet. It's a 21st century audience, so I'm going to try to give you a 21st century transmission. I'm also going to demonstrate with scientific evidence, clinical and anecdotal reports, that the suffering is caused by being in the wrong place at the right time, or the right place at the wrong time, and the obvious solution to the problem of suffering is to put your body, put your nervous system, and put your sperm egg supply in the right place at the right time. And I think tonight is such a time. You know, the geologists have just let the awful truth out of the closet. The tectonic plates that are active in this hemisphere are moving in such a way that California, as you probably know, is steadily moving upward and westward. At the same time, the rest of the United States is moving southward and downward. So, as we float upward and westward, the minor little perturbations as we separate, of course, are known as these minor Richter faults, but I sure want to urge anyone who wants to continue to grow and get smarter, when the big quake comes, be on the California side. I go around the country lecturing, and there's simply no question. I'm an intelligence agent. I'm out there picking up reports and reporting back to you what's going on. The real action in the sense of any sort of individual anarchy or energy and dynamism is in the Sun Belt. I literally do go up to a place like Buffalo in the middle of winter, and I say, Buffalo's an intelligence test. You failed. And you're going to have to repeat Buffalo 1A over and over again until you realize that we're not supposed to be bundled up. I really want to send out some electricity tonight and to get all of our nervous systems vibrating and shocked and moving, because I feel, as I'm sure you feel, that it's time to start sending out signals of intelligence and precise hope again. And certainly this is a place we can get such a an activity started. Tonight reminds me in some ways of a lecture that I gave in New York City in 1964, which is some 15 years ago. We had left Harvard, Richard Alpert and Ralph Metzner and others, and I was invited to give a lecture at Cooper Union. It's a very East Coast shrine, like, you know, the Acropolis or Canterbury Cathedral. And I was sitting in the dressing room backstage, and the man that ran this adult education for Cooper Union, whatever it was, came in the room. I remember this is 1964. Jimi Hendrix was an unknown left-handed guitar player in London. The Beatles were, hadn't done Sgt. Pepper. Bob Dylan was hadn't gone electric. This was in the primordial period. I was in the dressing room, and this very important man came in. He was the dean of the adult education, and he looked at me the way I was dressed. I had on a blue work shirt, blue jeans, tennis shoes, and red socks, because we were definitely sending a signal out to the adult authorities that we were not going to play that game anymore. So he looked at me, he said, "You can't give a lecture at Cooper Union without a coat and a tie. Abraham Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt and John Foster Dulles have spoken in this hallowed hall." So I said, "Well, you don't have to tell everyone to go home because it's over." So I came out to this East Coast audience, and I said, everything that I have to say tonight can be summed up in one sentence. You have to go out of your mind to use your head. And there was a pause, yeah. Then there was an applause. Now, this was 1964, so that was encouraging. And I said, okay, that took 1 minute. We got 59 minutes more, so I can just tell you stories to illustrate on the basis of scientific evidence why this is true. And at that time, the hot scientific issue had to do with imprinting. Ethologists like Conrad Lorenz and Nico Tinbergen, who got the Nobel Prize later, had been studying animal behavior, fowls and mammals and primates, and they found that there was a form of learning which took place totally in violation of all the laws of Skinnerian psychology, that animals seemed to have a one-shot learning in which they created a new reality. This was called the imprinting period, the critical period. And I was telling them stories about you can take, any animal, any fowl during the early periods is a critical period when whatever it sees there, it imprints as being the reality. And they were training animals to imprint ping pong balls. They had a goose that would imprint a big orange basketball. Well, for the rest of the life, that goose went around trying to suckle the basketball. When it got older, it tried to make the basketball. Couldn't score, but kept on trying. In other words, the entire game was being played with the object that was imprinted at the time. There was the great story about the hunters that shot a giraffe. When they drove the Jeep over, they found out that the giraffe had a little baby. As the hunter's Jeep moved close, obviously what happened was that the baby giraffe imprinted the Jeep, because for the rest of the giraffe lives, it paid no attention to lady giraffes, but always trying to mingle with, sell life insurance to, or fuck Jeeps. Which led to the uneasy... Now, scientists never apply these findings to the human situation, because if they did, the uneasy possibility would develop, like what orange basketballs and other peculiar objects did we imprint during the many critical periods of our development. Well, that was hot stuff back in 1964, and although even today your classic textbooks in psychology they talk about imprinting, and they imply that possibly imprinting might have something to do with the human situation. But no scientist or no human hive can face the possibilities of imprinting, because the whole thing gets pretty silly until our species has arrived at a point where it can do something about imprinting. Because none of us wants to think that we've just robots reacting to something that was accidentally there when we first came on the scene. So the concept that developed at Harvard and then at Millbrook and later seemed to have moved out to other places was the concept of serial imprinting, that for thousands of years the smartest women and men have known that through manipulating your nervous system by getting high in any way that you can suspend the old imprints and have a chance to start a new reality, because, as we all know in sophisticated San Francisco, we all live within the reality bubble that our nervous system projects. Now, still today, they don't give this concept enough credit, although there are about 40 million Americans who regularly practice the art and science of serial re-imprinting, anesthetic and other experiments which I need not detail. Now, I didn't hear you. What? Spike the punch. Spike the punch. Yeah. I'm still fighting some of my legal cases, and I'm out on parole, and the reporters are always asking me, well, what illegal drugs do you take? So, for a while I said, well, I don't do anything illegal, immoral, fattening, or that would please Ralph Nader. more recently, I was married December 19th. That's a little over a month ago. My wife Barbara is here tonight, and I want to... Barbara, who are you? Now, I'm not advocating anything, but I think fusion is wonderful. I want to make a few scientific generalizations tonight based upon my survey of the current literature and current science fiction, because science fiction always creates the science fact of a generation or two later. Sure, we all know that. The great honor to any side who goes to the science fiction writers. Now, Jules Verne wrote that story about the trip to the moon. It was over 100 years ago, and he had his rocket the same size as Apollo, left from Florida, went up there about the same amount of time, and landed within 200 miles of where the Apollos were landing in the Pacific Ocean. Now, science fiction writers have a certain power, don't they? Well, I want to summarize for you some of the hot ideas in science today, which have never been applied to our situation because the adult authorities around the hive, of course, want to use scientific breakthroughs to do the normal things, you know, make war and make money. And they're not too happy about individual members of the hive being really up to date and alertly tuned into new scientific developments, which might give power to the individual. Now, of course, if I at times poke fun at the adult authorities who run our hive, I'm sure you know that there's not one sense of bitterness or anger in me. I mean, after all, we won the Super Bowl, and it would be unsportsmanlike of us to complain about dirty playing by the Nixon group or whatever in the second half. Now, in the 60s, we were all concerned with neurology. It was the head trip. We all knew that it was, since it was our brain that created reality, you had to be pretty careful about shooting your neurological film, and you had to get the right setting and the right personnel. In other words, your life became all like a movie. You know, you have to get the right location and so forth. Neurology was the real revolution of the 60s. You're never going to read that in your oh, yeah, San Francisco, 20th century, right. Now, I'm going to be summarizing for you tonight the scientific issue which is going to be hot in the next 5 or 10 years. Using the neurological advances we made in the 60s, we can now begin to understand what evolution is all about. So I'm going to be talking about evolution. And the generalization I'm going to make is that your theory of evolution is the key to your own personal development or your understanding of what's happening around you. And far from being a textbook situation argued about by Darwinians and fruit flies, your theory of evolution determines really what kind of a life you're going to lead. Now, and right down the line, I want to tell you, the orthodox genetic biological theory of the United States today is exactly where psychological theory was in the late 50s and early 60s. They are trying to sell us a theory of evolution which is so ridiculous and so ludicrously useful to them and not to us that it's becoming clearer and clearer that your concept of evolution determines where and how fast and with whom we're going to go. Now, I'd like to tell you some animal stories. The point I'm making is that we are not here as a result of blind chance, statistical accident, copying errors. I'm sure you know that the classic theories of evolution claim that life began down here when sometime in the Precambrian ooze, there were a bunch of ammonia molecules, and they were having a party one night, and they invited some methane molecules, and some hydrogen boys and some oxygen girls dropped by, and the joint was hit by lightning, and they began to fuck. I mean, can you believe that? Now, they never explain, you know, exactly how the self-replicating mechanism comes. Yeah, it's clear that you can produce prebiotic amino acid molecules that way, but there's still no explanation in these orthodox textbooks as to exactly how the sperm-egg flirtation began. The Darwinian theory of natural selection is being overthrown now. Now, we have to give great honor to Charles... Yeah. Lied! I'm not doing any dishonor to... Oh, by the way, here's what I think we should do tonight. I've got an enormous amount of intelligence information to transmit. On the other hand, we're all active people who don't like to sit for a long time. So I'm going to talk for about a half hour more, then we'll take a break, and I'll come back and talk for another 40 minutes. Also, I urge you not to be polite. San Francisco requires rowdy crowds. So think of it as a rock concert. I mean, we got some of the greatest rock musicians in the world here. Please move around and, get it on. Or I'll really be irritated if any one of you sits through more than a boring minute. All right. Now, there's one other problem, of course. In dealing with an audience of this sort, which is a very 21st, 22nd century audience, there's a tremendous variety in nervous systems because we know as we evolve, we get more complicated, more unique, and our uniqueness and intelligence allows us to make higher liaisons and better link-ups. But there's a tremendous, tremendous variety of nervous systems in this hall tonight. In the old days, if you gave a lecture, you were either for communism or against it, or for Catholicism or against it. Middle East, they're still going on that way. But here, there, I see some happy amoeba floating back there, and I see some wild, romantic, feudal barbarians galloping around over there, and I see a lot of 23rd century people flying around, so... See, the problem is this, that to talk, to send signals, we have to scope and scan, and these nervous systems are dialing and tuning, so... If we get to a point where I seem to be digressing, we have two possibilities. One, you can think you're stupid, and we know that's not true. The other is that I'm a brain-toasted acid head, and just be patient. The third possibility is we're all moving so fast that we're here and back, and if you have missed me for a second, I'm going to be zapping through in a minute, so don't worry. All right. I'm going to tell you some animal stories. The point is that evolution is not accidental. The Darwinians would have you believe that not only was it an accidental thunderbolt in the Precambrian mud that started it, but that all evolution and differentiation of form has been due to accidents, copying errors, carbon copy smudges, and that if it hadn't been any accidents, we'd all be happy unicellular amoebas sucking and floating. Now, I'm not here to knock sucking and floating, but obviously there's more to handling this planet and off than that. So I don't believe that we're here as a sequence of errors. I don't think that 3.5 billion years could take us from the amoeba to Howard Cosell and Monday Night Football. I mean, no way. It's got to be, there's an intelligence behind all this. For example, I cite you our friend, the monarch butterfly. Okay, suppose we're all hanging out in a Mendocino forest, and there are all these insects running around, crawling. And there are two caterpillars doing the same insect thing, eating and crawling and so forth. Then suddenly the two caterpillars get cocoons, and what happens? They come out. But they come out different. One is a beautiful phosphorescent, psychedelic, lemon, green, blue butterfly. And the other one is a monarch. The monarch butterfly then, as you know, starts, if it's the right time, the right generation, the right time to make the move, because not every generation does it. I repeat, not every generation does it. I repeat once more, not every generation does it. But some generations of monarchs start flying south. They fly from 4,000 to 7,000 miles south to exactly the tree where their psychedelic great-grandmother or father were three generations before. The exact same tree. Now, how do you account for that? The distance would be, in terms of the human body and the mileage, would be what? Going around the world by on foot, you know, 10 times. How do they do that? Now, the Darwinian theory would tell you that it's all accident. Some monarch headed for San Francisco and somehow the weather pushed it over to Almeida, and then, you know, it didn't get eaten because, you know, and because the Darwinian theory says it all. Listen, the Darwinian theory is a male macho prim theory. It's total sperm aggressive intelligence. Yeah. Those that fight best and fuck most spread the sperm, and the lady monarchs just say, hey, yeah. Hi. It's all plain. Oh, I should say, I started saying before, I give great honor to Charles Darwin. He belongs in the Genetic Hall of Fame. He had a tough situation to deal with. It was his unhappy task in the 19th century to deal with between 2,000 and 3,000 years of monotheism. And they had to fight this notion of creation that a male, macho, shepherd, paranoid, FBI-type god did it all in 7 days and said, it's mine, and anyone doesn't do what I want or eats trees, you know. Particularly, he didn't want you to eat the fruit of that second tree, which was the fruit of longevity and life extension and mortality, lest we become like him. Now, Darwin had his work cut out for him. So in order to deal with this Judeo-Christian concept, Darwin had to go to the opposite extreme and say, there's no intelligence whatsoever, because intelligence, an intelligent creator, you know, leads right back to that, because, you know, it couldn't. Darwin couldn't conceive of the fact that if the thing was done by an intelligent design, it had to be a man, right? In fact, the possibility that it wasn't a man was something that had to be dealt with. Why did Darwin have to do this? Well, because monotheism is over. And he was the hitman. Now, 3,000 years before that, monotheism was necessary. You had a bunch of tribes running around. Each tribe had its own little gig. One would carve wood, and the other would carve stone, and one would do that. So you had to have some megalomaniac male. You had to have a megalomaniac male saying, I have the divine power to pull these enormous tribal groups together so that they could build the pyramids, so they could build the great mathematical design institutes of Babylon. You had to have that, because an enormous anthill with millions of humans, they can't be screwing around by God. There's one God that runs it. And in the Judeo-Christian situation, of course, it's a hymn. Now, that was Darwin's situation. He had to deal with that. So, the Darwinian theory, I mean, it's a locker room joke. According to the Darwinian theory, when the male hurtles between 400 and 500 million sperm into the female reproductive tract at each ejaculation, I repeat, 400 to 500 million sperm, then ensues, are you ready? Countdown, the greatest race in history. Can you imagine 500 million sperm doing Mark Spitz swimming? The scenario apparently ends that when they get to Miss Egg, she's waiting there, and she said, the first one across the finish line, gets, come in, baby. Now, how playing fields of Eton can you get? I was at a cocktail party once, and a biologist came up to me and said, well, congratulations, Timothy, you were the one that made it. I said, what do you mean made it? Said, well, you were the one that swam the fastest and got to the egg first. I said, are you crazy? I didn't run. I floated with the tide up there watching carefully, and I studied exactly what she liked and didn't like. And I saw her laser shoot down all those macho athletes. So finally, at the right moment, I showed up with flowers and perfume or whatever was needed to let her know. And she said, I want you! See, evolution is very important. If you read Scientific American 3 issues ago, the entire issue was devoted to evolution. And over, they went right down the list of all the basic tenets of orthodox evolutionary theory. And 7 out of 8 were wrong, and 7 out of 8 were wrong exactly in the way that would keep us from realizing that we can change, we can mutate. For example, the old theory, by old I mean the ones that they're still teaching in your colleges, says that new speciation takes tens of millions of years to create a new species. Well, if that's so, let's go back to quaaludes, huh? Why bother? Well, the facts of the matter are that's not true. In the right time, at the right place, with the right chemicals, and evolution leaps and jumps, and quantum jumps, and quantum leaps, and speciation. See, what's coming back in phase, because everything comes around once again, is Lamarckianism. Remember, Lamarck said that what happened in the lifetime of the individual reflected in the species. Now, in the gross morphological bodily thing, it isn't true that if a carpenter does this a lot, his daughter or his son is going to have enormous biceps. It's not acquired characteristics in the neuromuscular mechanical sense. But you've got to believe that she's smart. You've got to believe that she's using every technique of intelligence agents. You've got to believe that maybe we are her intelligence agents out here with our nervous systems picking up information. You've got to aesthetically entertain the possibility that the DNA biological guy wisdom knows exactly what's going on all the time. And a matter of fact, once you look at the scientific reports, you see buried away little articles which have the implications so staggering that because they prove that DNA is picking up information not only during lifetimes but even from season to season. I cite you, for example, the case of the foxes in France. Because of urbanization and mechanical agriculture, the fox population of France was almost obliterated. So some French naturalists found a few, they call them dens of foxes, and studied them. And much of their surprise, they found out that the fox mothers were giving birth not to 2, but to 7, 8, or 9 in the litter. And the ratio of female to male was about 3 to 1 in favor of the female. So instead of 2, 1 male, 1 female, you were getting each fox litter with 3, 4, or 5 females. Now that means that in one generation, the foxes looked around the neighborhood. They went down to the old corner disco and said, hey, what's happening to us? CNS, central nervous system, reports that to RNA, and RNA say, hey, we're in a little trouble up there. So the biological genetic dial is turned. Now, you know what happens if they get too many foxes in one space? The dial will be turned down again. Are you enjoying this? Am I being too scientific? Yeah? I got the message. Okay. If you want, when I come back or later, I'll talk about the 60s and the 70s. What? All right, I'm going to tell you one more animal story, and then we can draw some implications from that. How many of you saw that television special on the termites, narrated by Orson Welles? Wow, boy, they couldn't let that out in prime time. It was too hot. You know that the sociobiology, behavioral genetics, the new hot philosophy and sociologies are based to a certain extent on analyses of social insects and social animals. Now, the termite hive is the most successful terrestrial social situation. The termite hive has been around for 100 million years. Now, the human species goes back in our form, what, 10,000, 20,000? 100 million years. The dinosaurs came and went, and, you know, glaciers came and went, and the termite hive had worked out the perfect social situation. They have got down terrestrial living. They're the smartest terrestrial creatures, apparently. The way they do it, they use two techniques, which are obvious techniques. Like if you're her trying to spread your intelligence agents into every ecological niche and every square millimeter of the planet and beyond, you certainly would realize that the way to increase the intelligence and therefore the aesthetics and therefore the harmony and the fun of your species would be to have what's called temporal and structural caste. Temporal caste means that you go through stages, like metamorphosis. at a certain age, a small ant plays one role, taking care of the babies. At a larger, little older, it works around the hive. A little older, it goes out on errands. A little older, it gets to do guard duty. A little later, it gets to be rock and roll ant. You know. there are also specialized functions, or what are called castes, in an anthill. Now, you know, the warrior ants and the worker ants. Now, there is a direct, immediate relationship between the egg queen of the hive, who in size would be about twice as big as this room compared to one of us, if we were rock and roll ants, termites. The queen simply gets information from everything that's going on around and produces exactly the castes of ants that are needed. For example, if there's a war outside with the red ants, you know, the kind of capitalist or the communist ants, whatever they call them, and we've suffered some losses. Maybe we lost 50,000 of our glorious warrior ants. The word is passed back to the egg intelligence. How is it passed on? Well, this is another one of the amusing aspects of biology. You know, they never really think through the implications of what's going on. Most biologists scorn the ants because you know how ants communicate? They don't have the Reader's Digest. They don't have Channel 4. They communicate by spit. I don't want to shock anyone here, but I want to tell everyone in this room that every time you put your tongue in the mouth of a loved one or vice versa, you are exchanging more information in 1 second than all the Library of Congress is in history. So, the word is passed back until, chain by chain, until egg wisdom gets the word, we've lost 50,000 warriors. So she simply turns the dial, and for the next few hours, a day or two, what are produced? Warrior ants. For example, if there's a drought and no water out there, hey, she's getting that message. She then turns up the dial and creates a caste of ants who can dig down 10 to 15 feet, which would, for us being digging down like 5 miles, to bring up one drop of water, which is put above the egg supply, and so forth. Now, there's one final thing I'd like to tell you about the termite ants. It sounds rather dull, doesn't it? I mean, year after year going on, millions of years going on in that same ant. Of course, each anthill is designed with more architectural perfection than our Gothic cathedrals. Each anthill has to be in tune with the ecological situation, the nature of the soil, the amount of the city, and so forth. But it's still kind of dull. So what happens after when the right time comes? When the right time, because blossoming is always a matter of time, when the right time comes, she turns the dial and produces a new species of ant. These species of ants are about 5 times bigger than the ordinary ants.
And they've got wings. They've got wings that go from here all the way over to there. Glorious silver blue wings. But see the problem. You all know the problem. Everyone in this room knows the problem of the winged creature inside the hive. How are you going to get out? So, she's got it all taped out. She creates other groups of ants who make runways. And slowly, almost floating, come the silver ants out, out, out. They begin to fly a little, and they circle the enormous hive, which can be the shape of a mushroom, can be the shape of anything that fits the terrain and the ecology. And when they totally cover the hive with these shimmering, quivering, silver-blue wings, at that moment, they all move out. Why all the way around? Because she wants to make sure that it's a 360-degree circle. The female ants move first. They fly a certain place, feels good, and the female ant descends, sends out a perfume, beats her wings so the perfume goes out, and in time, she's joined by a male ant. The minute they kiss, they drop their wings, they make love, take one look at the sky, and they burrow down into the ground to start a new planet, or a new, whatever you want to call it. Okay, one more scientific fact, and then we can go on to conclusions. Every woman in this audience, shortly after conception, while still in uterine condition, each woman in this audience was given 1 million eggs. That was your egg supply. It was to last you through your assignment on this planet. Every month after adolescence, one or two of this enormous supply of potential species intelligence is dropped down the fallopian tube. Fallopian tube. Dig that word, tube. Tube's in. I was on a television program in Los Angeles with a very nervous announcer, and I began talking to you. I said, looked right in the camera. I said, do you realize every woman watching this program has 1 million eggs? And the announcer said, more or less. I said, yeah, more or less. tube isn't one of those four-letter words that you're not allowed to say in public. So, now, if I'm a domesticated primitive primate from the late 20th century, moving quickly into the 21st century. But if I can figure out a better way to handle that than the Darwinian scientists come up with, I'm sure that the biological intelligence worked it out. I would certainly not let the intersection of sperm and egg, which is going to determine exactly the future of the species, I would not let that be up to chance. So here is a situation. You have 1 million eggs in the female, and you have each lovemaking 400 to 500 million sperm. I don't think that's chance. If there's ever a time in the history of a species when you'd want to bring to bear all the evidence, all the data, all the precise anticipations of what needed out there, I think that genetics and obstetrics and gynecology is going to be published very soon. A lot of data which indicates that the period of ovulation is a period of tremendous selectivity. And based upon the information that your nervous system is giving the egg machinery inside the body of everyone in this hall tonight, I think decisions are being made. I'm not saying this is definite, but it sure is a lot more fun. It's a lot more hopeful. It's a lot more optimistic. It's a lot more aesthetic. And you either believe in nothing whatsoever except chance, or you're going to believe in a biological intelligence which knows what she's doing. I think, as I said before, that the intersection between the one of the 400 million sperm and that egg, which is selected exactly at the time, is the intersection of species future creation. What? What happened in the 60s? Okay, the 60s was a genetically designed and programmed pedomorphic revolt against adult authority. Another technique used by egg intelligence, I'm going to answer your question. Give me a little warm-up, okay? All right. I dedicate this one to you. I hope you like it. geneticists have also found out something interesting about how evolution works. Now, remember, they don't really want to know too much about how evolution works, because the more they realize how precise and how aesthetic and how wonderful it works, then they can't talk about chance anymore. But one of the obvious techniques that biologists have discovered is used to create evolution. It's this fact, that species only evolve from the juvenile or the larval or the pre-adult form. The adult form is the specialized form. Hello.
Are the space people coming?
We are the space people and we are going.
When are they coming? Where are they coming?
Well, we could be them.
Are we them?
I am. Barbara is. Okay. Consider us on loan from the 21st century. Yeah. Oh, listen. Oh, yeah. Well, I'll get to that later. I'm sure that most of the people in this room, most people in this room had that discovery early in life. You looked around at the adults, at the uncles and the aunts and the grandparents and the... you watch what's going on in the adult world, and you felt out of place. You felt quite alienated. Now, if you were lucky, you didn't make this show. You didn't blurt it out. They didn't send you off to a mental health clinic. But if I were going to make any suggestions, egg intelligence, and I'm not really, but I'm sure she's considered this possibility, that at any one time, as our species travels as a huge egg ship through time, generations moving through time, at any one period, you'd want to have half of the people being born with future nervous systems and half with past nervous systems. You have to have your roots. You have to keep the... we don't give anything up. We still got a paleolith brain. We've still got an amoeba brain. We've still got a reptile brain. But I'm sure that most of the people who have felt alienated, I think many of the people are put in mental hospitals, are people that simply were born with nervous systems that were, we call, futique, as opposed to antique. Now, the point here, see, is if you're going to feel, synced, you've got to be in a place where there are people who share your reality. And if you've got a 21st century nervous system which doesn't get off on 4-foot mammalian barnyard politics, you've got to get your nervous system to a place where it can hook up and create realities with those that share your time. The key to your brain is time. Brains are cranked out by DNA just like models of Porsches, 79, 52, and so forth. And it's all necessary. There's no good guy, bad guy scenario here. Some are... I'm a robot. I admit it. I have no choice. From the first time that I looked around and I saw what was going on, I just felt that I had to move the whole thing up to my time. Now, the trick of doing this is simply geographic. I got a new book coming out called The Intelligence Agents, and the main point of the book is neurogeography, that where you are determines which circuits of your brain are being used. See, if you're in Belfast, Ireland, you've got a 15th century or 16th century brain, because all you're concerned about is Catholics killing Protestants and Protestants killing Catholics. In general, the farther east you go, the more, do you see what's happening in Iran? How could that happen in Iran? Iran had all the oil, it had all the computers, it had all the electronics, it had to bring in discos. I mean, what do they want to complain about there? They want to go back to the 8th, 9th, and 10th century. Pakistan, paper today, said the guys running Pakistan are going to bring back the old Islamic code. They're going to cut off the hand of a thief. Women go back in veils. There's not going to be any more education, which means Pakistan is going to give up, trying to become a modern country. Now, what happens? What's going to happen in Iran? What's going to happen in Pakistan? And this Islamic movement is going all through the East, Middle East. What's going to happen is those Pakistanis who have to be educated, who have to learn how to do physics or have to learn how to play rock and roll, are going to move as far west as their nervous systems will gear them to. So to be in the right place means to be in the right time. It's so simple. To be in the right place, you're in the right time. Tune the place you are to the vibrations of your the brain circuits that you want to activate at the time. Now, there are times when you want to be an amoeba. There are times when you want to, gallop around like an athlete or like a... times you want to charge out in the woods and become a mammal. Great. But I didn't answer your question because I dedicated that one to you. All right. Now, let me answer his question. I just said, future people are here. Well, and lots of us, I don't know if you are, but lots of us here. There you go. How about a show of hands? How many space people here? Hey! Now, let me answer his question. The way evolution works... the way evolution works is this. Evolution never tries to change grown-ups. When you go home tonight, look in the dictionary for the word adult. You'll find the word adult is the past participle of the verb to grow. It says, adult, that form of a species which is no longer metamorphizing and has reached its final stage. Adult means over-specialized. So DNA knows better than to try to screw around with that. Now, pedomorphosis, or neoteny, is the technique used by DNA that at a certain moment, and it's all due to success, which gives you pollution and overpopulation. Now, I know that ecological consciousness has made us all aware of the pollution. Now, the way to do away with the pollution, of course, is not to stop all technology. The way to, first of all, you have to understand that pollution is a signal that triggers off the next movement in our nervous systems. So when I say that pollution is a valuable sign of pain, it's a signal to activate our nerves. Let me give you an example. I set you the example of a beehive, because we're so close to pollution as humans, we don't want to hurt Ralph Nader's feelings or anything. So let's talk about a beehive. We'll call that Beehive America. We'll say this American beehive came into this incredible clover patch, and they were fast moving far out, individual bees anyway. They all escaped from the old hives because they had some dissident Quaker Shaker Thomas Jefferson restlessness. Anyway, these American bees get this clover patch, and it's fabulous. It's the best beehive there's ever been. They went out there and they got the clover. That is fantastic dance. Communication was terrific. They come back to the hive and make honey. More and more honey. More honey, the more you make love. More you make love, the more bees. The hive got to be the most successful, fast-growing hive in history with the best communication system. However, some of the older bees finally looked around and said, what's happening to this hive? There's too much noise of all those wings, too many bodies, there's a lot of bee shit on the floor. this hive, we got to cut this out. I don't want as much honey. Don't make love so much. Let's limit our growth. Come on. No, that's not what happens.
What happened to you while you were in jail?
I just went in jail when you said that, now I'm out. Want some water? Are you sure?
What do you have to tell us? Tell us something.
Okay. All right. Oh, I talked about the beehive, how pollution is a sign it's a sign to change and move. Now, what happens in evolution and pedomorphosis and your question about the 60s, works like this. The dinosaurs have the turf deal down. The dinosaurs figured out that the bigger you are, the more armor plating. Listen, you become like you control that turf, you know, like a Sicilian mafia controls it, or like the Irish mafia controls it. No one's going to fuck with a kid of a dinosaur. So, there are more and more dinosaurs, and they're moving out, and they're eating all the, great butt. With size and with armor plating goes you give away mobility. Mobility is nobility. The solution to almost every problem is move, either inward or outward. And the dinosaurs couldn't move. So, listen, it got to be a terrible situation. You talk about pollution, you talk about Times Square, you talk about the freeways of San Francisco. There were so many dinosaurs out there in the swamp sinking in, and the young dinosaurs took one look. There goes J. Edgar Hoover. There goes L.B. Johnson. There goes Mamie Eisenhower. We aren't going to grow up. And from the fetal or juvenile dinosaurs developed, as you probably know, wing creatures, the avian creatures who fly far and fast. So, the 1960s answer question was, I could give you dozens of examples of how evolution works from the larvals and the juveniles. I'll tell you one more thing about human pedomorphosis. As you know, the key characteristic of the human species is we have not matured. We're embryonic. We haven't overspecialized yet. In Scientific America, about 3 years ago, there were these four X-ray photos of the skull of an embryonic chimp and of a human fetus, almost the same. An adult chimp with an enormous big jaw, adult human being, almost like the fetal human being and the fetal chimp. The implications are obvious. We didn't grow from the apes. We refused to become apes. And we... Now, what happened in the 1960s was this. The time had come to avoid terminal adulthood. A generation of young people, and there I could spend hours giving you the ecological, historical, and genetic, biological, neurological things that happened to make that come, the first baby boom generation after Hiroshima and so forth, but that generation in the 60s, millions and millions of young people simply refused to buy the adult image, the adult model. And you had those incredible musical prophets and minstrels. And see, the interesting thing about the 60s was we were unified in the 60s because we all were refusing to identify with that adult authority. So there was that, Dylan was saying, she talks about man and God and law. She's 68, but she says she's 54. Well, I ain't going to work on Maggie's farm no more. And the Beatles writing those songs about she's leaving home, what did we do wrong, can't get no satisfaction. Go right down the line, the great San Francisco sound groups. The signal is being sent out. We simply aren't going to over-specialize in the careerist 1950s. Don't worry, the 1970s are not like the 50s. The 1970s are highly individual and highly, a very fast-moving decade, but not visibly and not in the sense of demonstrations. one of the messages that I have right now is, the message is this. I don't advocate anything, but I urge you to think it over. I urge you at all costs to avoid terminal adulthood.
That's so happy.
What's going to happen? I think we're getting better. I'm better now than I was 10 years ago. I'm learning. I'm changing. I'm growing. You are too. What time is it? How long have I been talking? You want to take a break now or in 10 minutes? 10 minutes. Claire Frost has just arrived. Hey, dear. All right, we'll talk for 10 more minutes. All right. Yeah, well, if anyone is restless, get up, move around. Listen, yeah, I got a head full of ideas that are driving me insane, so. I don't think I have to talk about neurogeography. The principle is very simple. When you go back east, it literally is back east, you're going down in time and back in evolution. When you get... I know. You're not back there. I've spent about a third, almost a half of my adult life in the old world, sometimes voluntarily and sometimes on the run. And it's not chauvinism to say that each kilometer that you move east, there's more reliance on tradition, there's more reliance on authoritarian setups, there's less confidence in individuality, there are more blocks to enthusiasm and to change. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. Matter of fact, if you really understand the principles of neurogeography, you can time travel. You know, like, you can go to Uganda. I think most smart people in Uganda have left. I once said, is there one intelligent person left in Uganda? And a guy said, yeah, one. I know. Now, throughout evolutionary history, when you talk about geography, it's always a hot subject. You know, the Neapolitans against the Romans and the Carthaginians. There's always been this incredible tension. There's an incredible intense love affair going on now between California and New York and the East Coast, because that's the past capital and this is the forward. And there's always that. And of course, it has to do with style. It has to do with beauty. It has to do with individual. So therefore, it's very sexual and it's very, you know, and so forth. It's a place to be in this electricity between New York and San Francisco and L.A. And there's no chauvinism here. Go exactly to the place where you want your nervous system. Get on and then move to the time niche. See, the point is, you know, when you look at a map, it's got those hours, those meridians. Those aren't hours. Those are centuries. Yeah. I think I'd like to tell you a story or two about the 60s, because you wait to the 70s?
What are you doing now?
I'm doing my best to... I'm doing my best to send out electricity. I think we got a tremendously highly charged situation here. I'd like tonight to be one of those nights we all look back on and say, you know, we all changed together, and that's what I'm trying to do. Is it possible in jaded old San Francisco? I think it's possible. Yeah.
I suppose that's self-evident, but...
Yeah, okay. Yeah. San Francisco is fabulous. San Francisco is an outpost frontier town where the past and the future merge and meet.
They've given up on L.A. Everyone is just floating around in some self-described, self-indulgent future down there. but the real tension between the past and the future is more in a place like San Francisco. There are more Easterners come here first, and then you get this... it's always been, I think, that kind of a town now in spiritual and neurological sense. I mean... Not at all. See, it depends upon... the question is there more happening in L.A. than there is in San Francisco? Well, that'll be the last question I answer tonight. Okay, I'm going to take a 5-minute break and think up some new ideas. I'll be right back.
You're listening to the Psychedelic Salon, where people are changing their lives one thought at a time.
Perhaps the first thing I should say right now is that, yes, it actually is possible to avoid terminal adulthood. I'm living proof of it. And you can be too, I might add. So, were you born with a future nervous system or a past nervous system? That's an interesting question, isn't it? And if I happen to have been born with a past version, then the next question I'd ask is whether there's a way to get an upgrade. And actually, now that I think about it, I guess we all know the answer to that one. So, let's move on. By the way, that Cooper Union lecture that he spoke about in his talk just now was the one I podcast back in program number 127, in case you want to go back and listen to it again. As much as I'd like to go on and tell you right now about the recent Visionary Artists podcast on which I was a guest, I'll instead just recommend that you visit dopefiend.co.uk and sample their whole lineup of audio delights. And also don't forget about KMO, Diet Soap, Gnostic Media, Mystic Mind, Shrink Wrap Radio, Biota, and Ape Reality, just to mention a few of the programs I listen to from time to time. And one closing thought, which I plan on elaborating more on in my next novel, but I've been noticing that there are a lot, and I mean a lot, of young, highly skilled, and intelligent people who can't find work. Now, I also know that there's a very good chance that this coming November, the citizens of California are going to legalize cannabis. Now, while getting together and talking about what kind of infrastructure is going to be required to support all of our current growers and keep the big corporations from pushing our friendly growers out of business, that kind of conversation is illegal right now. But once cannabis is legal, the floodgates will be opened and the next California gold rush will begin. So if I was looking for work right now, I'd be making plans to head to the coast next year and join in this new industry, one which will eventually spread across the continent as prohibition gradually comes to an end state by state. So that should give you a little something to think about. But for now, I'm going to close today's podcast by reminding you that this and most of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon are freely available for you to use in your own audio projects under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike 3.0 license. And if you have any questions about that, just click the Creative Commons link at the bottom of the Psychedelic Salon webpage, which you can find at psychedelicsalon.org. And for now, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.